I'm Emily Jashinsky.
I'm Josh Hammer.
I'm Rachel Bovard.
And I'm Will Chamberlain, standing in for Ben Weingarten.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. We, as always, have four great segments for you today. We're going to start off by talking about how the Republican Party is hesitant to call out the racism of Biden's nominees. We're going to be talking about how the Constitution does indeed protect unborn life. We're going to talk about Facebook trying to wade into the metaverse as the next frontier in our such pleasurable digital lives and our digital existences. And then Will's going to close us out by talking about the much discussed eviction moratorium, the CDC. Yes, you heard that right. The CDC is imposing. So to start things off, I'll go over to Rachel right off the bat.
So a little bit of a different topic from me today. We're not talking about big tech. Emily will tackle that one later. But I did want to talk about David Chipman, who is the Biden administration's nominee to head ATF, tobacco, alcohol, firearms, all that good stuff. Now, if you've been paying any attention at all, this guy is a zealot. This guy is a former ATF agent, but is wildly opposed to the use of firearms, the ownership of firearms. He himself has made several claims about how firearms work that are incorrect. After he left the ATF, he worked for Giffords, which is, you know, a well-known anti-gun control group. Host of issues with this guy. He was at Waco, by the way, and had and like made completely bizarre claims about his quote was like Waco cult members used two Berettas to shoot down a helicopter, which never even happened. So, you know, he's extreme and uninformed, and I think would be terrible in this job. But the issue I really want to talk about here is that, you know, Senate Republicans have done a fairly good job grilling him in committee. But over the course of time during his confirmation process, they were given information by the American Accountability Foundation. Daily Caller wrote this up recently. American Accountability Foundation gave them information showing that David Chipman, in his personnel record, has had accusations of racism, racist comments suggesting that Black officers must have cheated on exams to get where they've, you know, gotten very, very just really kind of disgusting stuff. Complaints were made. AAF presented this information to Senate Judiciary staff who did nothing. And this is the thrust of the story, is that they were given this information, they did nothing at all. And when called out on it, we're like, well, we don't want to, you know, spread rumors and, you know, unfounded gossip about nominees. And the reason I want to bring this up is because, one, I don't think it's gossip. I think if it's in someone's personnel file, you know, this is something that's actually valid and worth looking into. But two, this is the same committee that confirmed Brett Kavanaugh, how many, you know, years ago now, where it was a what were those rumors, right? I think there was less basis for the accusations against Brett Kavanaugh than we have about these allegations of potentially racist and inappropriate comments from David Chipman. And yet the Republicans are like, no, we're not going to be like those mean Democrats. We're just going to be really nice about it. And, you know, I'm not asking them to burn down the committee room. I'm not asking them to, you know, tear this guy's life apart. I'm asking them to pick up the phone. I'm asking them to call and look at his record and see what it actually says. And none of that has been done. And I guess the reason this story jumped out at me is because it is time and time again, the right plays itself for fools, because we simply say, look, if we're nice to Biden's obviously radical ATF nominee, somehow Democrats are going to return the favor. They're not. And we know this. And again, I'm not suggesting we go the lengths they did, which, by the way, you know, really border on, you know, holding up the process of lawmaking, I would suggest. If you remember what that Kavanaugh hearing was like, members, you know, or protesters throwing themselves at senators when they were walking to the floor to try and vote, you know, people banging on the doors of the committee room, Handmaid's Tale, you know, dressed women marching around the Capitol. It was insane. I'm not suggesting Republicans do that. I'm suggesting when given information about a nominee that comes from a credible source and is worth looking into, pick up the phone, for crying out loud. And instead, you know, they're very defensive in this article. They're like, well, I'm, you know, baseless rumor and speculation. I throw it open to you all, because this is why the right loses in so many cases. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not suggesting we turn into the crazy left. I'm suggesting we work with a little bit of diligence here. open for comment.
I was gonna say, it actually reminds me of what's happening with the nominee for the Office of the Civil Rights at the Department of Education, Kathleen Lehman, or Lehman. I'm not clear on how you pronounce it, but she was the chief enforcer of the Obama era Title IX policies on college campuses for years during the Obama administration. And she got some questioning about it during her hearing, but she's going to be confirmed. And Republicans are not making hay of this in the way that they should be. I mean, it's actually insane. This is like such an easy battle to win, to Rachel's point. Like, these are easy battles. These are people who are unqualified for their positions, demonstrably unqualified for their positions. There's actually like no reason whatsoever that you should be letting these people just sort of quietly be confirmed. Maybe it's inevitable that they're going to get confirmed. That's what happens. You know, elections have consequences. That's absolutely true. This should be something that they're like, I didn't get a single pitch on what was happening with this Ed nominee. Not once. Like, nobody was trying to say, like, just flagging this for you in the press, like, maybe you want to look into this. I saw it like in Reason, and I couldn't believe how ridiculous this nominee was, that anybody would. And so I think it's the same thing, that like Republicans are resting on their laurels when it comes to some of these nominees. I actually don't know why. And that's a question that I want to throw open to Will and Josh. I think Rachel makes a good point that Republicans are under this ridiculous impression that Democrats will return the favor of their collegiality at some point, which obviously is not going to happen. But I also wonder if they just don't care, if there's a nihilism to the Biden administration that is informing the way the Republicans approach these battles. And even if it doesn't matter in the upper chamber, which it may not, even if it doesn't matter there, it can matter in the culture. It can matter in the conversation. When Rachel, to Rachel's point, nominating somebody who has said this stuff is a telling statement on your priorities right there. Like, that's a telling statement on your priorities in and of itself. The same thing with this education nominee, somebody who enforced the kangaroo courts, has defended the kangaroo courts and said that Betsy DeVos took America's campuses into a place where people could rape with impunity. It's outrageous. It's insane. And I don't, like, that's my best guess as to what's happening, but I'll throw it up into everybody else.
So a quick apology to the viewers for the less than ideal setup this week. I'm recording this from the road, but all good, obviously. So look, Emily, I'm happy that you mentioned this person whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce, lemon, you know, potato, potato, whatever. My dear friend Max Eden has been kind of hitting this one pretty hard. He had a good piece at City Journal. He had a follow-up blog post at the AEI blog. Max is now a fellow at AEI. But the silence on this and this ATF nominee is pretty deafening. I hadn't even heard of what was going on with this ATF nominee until Rachel apprised the four of us. This is what she wanted to talk about today. And I'm like a conservative opinion editor. I'm like pretty in the know. So like I literally was like not aware that this was going on here. But look, from my perspective, I just think that Republicans have been trained to not touch race or race-related issues, even in like the abstract, with a 10, 20, 30, or 50-foot pole. They just don't want to get near it here. I mean, it's kind of why, even on the critical race theory stuff, which, by the way, politically is a total winning issue for Republicans, for conservatives. We're seeing this increasingly play out by the day with every new like Barry Weiss Substack post or whatever. It's clearly kind of coming around to, I think, at this point, being a 2022 midterm election winner for the GOP. But even on an issue like that, you kind of hear people talking about like critical race theory using like the euphemism, the vague phraseology, as opposed to like actually kind of getting in there and talking about the spirit murdering all that. Every so often you'll hear a Republican flesh it out in some level of detail, but it's usually always just kind of teetering around the edges. And, you know, look, I think the kind of Republican who's going to become a United States Senator, who is going to get on the Senate Judiciary Committee, is necessarily, for the most part, there are dispensations to this, obviously. You know, we have our Josh Hawleys and Ted Cruz's on the Senate Judiciary Committee. But with some dispensations, they're generally going to be folks who have made political advancements like the be-all, end-all of their kind of adult livelihood here, right? And I'm obviously like painting here with an extremely broad brush. But the way to do so as a Republican, historically, at least for the past 20, 30 years, as the left has kind of taken a greater and greater share of the media and higher ed and all the institutions that matter, is to stick to the quote unquote nice issues, you know, your economic issues, your 28% like income tax rate issues, your capital gains, supply side tax cut stuff. And just don't talk about this. Don't talk about race, don't talk about immigration. So that's my best guess as to what is going on here. Of course, a recurring theme, like a leitmotif of this particular podcast, I feel like we hit week in and week out, is that especially in kind of an increasingly like realigned GOP over the next 5 to 10 years, these cultural issues are where the fight is. Those are where our voters are. Those are where our people are. And, you know, the longer that the politicians themselves wait to catch up to that, you know, I fear Republicans will have a harder and harder time kind of winning sooner rather than later.
Yeah, no, I think Josh is absolutely onto something there. Like while there's certainly plenty of virtue in the fight over something like Cuba, for example, the fact that our Congress people are so enthusiastic to talk about Cuba as like the number one issue, while there's huge obvious issues that are domestic that are very relevant, but that they're scared of. One could be like the treatment of the January 6th defendants or anything to do with race, really. So I think that there's that part of it. There's the fact that Republicans are, I mean, it's funny, this isn't even a situation where Republicans are worried about setting a bad precedent. The bad precedent was already set by, you know, the Kavanaugh treatment and the treatment of Republicans in the previous administration. And yet we're still seeing this incredibly abusive, we're still seeing Republicans just take it easy on these nominees, despite the fact that they certainly didn't take it easy on us. It's lazy. It's just, I mean, there's not really a lot of good or justifiable explanations for this. I mean, clearly this guy should be confronted over racist comments. I feel like maybe Republicans feel like, I think as Josh sort of either said or alluded to, that they worry that they're gonna stumble over a race issue and maybe end up looking like Steve King or something. And that's perhaps a problem with our general literacy, that they're just like terrified of this terrain and aren't capable of arguing from it. Which itself is a massive weakness, given that it's essentially the central moral question of like 5 or 6 different serious policy debates. And if our people aren't able to like be literate on it, then that's a generally bad thing. And I think there's, as you know, again, it just connects to a general lack of self-righteousness that, you know, we actually have a coherent position to defend here. Racism is bad, discrimination on the basis of race is bad. And no matter whatever prejudice plus power formulation that Democrats use, that doesn't change the fact that what you're doing is bigoted and wrong, even if you manage to persuade yourself it's not racist. So like we're the ones standing for individual dignity. We can just stand on that and stand against people who actually do say racist things.
Yeah, it really shouldn't be that hard. But before kind of transitioning to the next segment, I mean, Rachel, you have more Capitol Hill experience than the three of us. I'd be curious what your best guess is as to what's going on here.
Well, pair this with the fact that these Senate Republicans are confirming all these Biden nominees without any, you know, compunction or delay or even filibuster. This after, I mean, the filibuster's gone, but there's things they're doing like giving back time, you know, easing the means by which these nominees are confirmed, voting for them in droves, by the way. Like, if you remember back in the Trump era, you know, Democrats filibustered every single one of his nominees. Mike Pence had to break ties on so many of those Kavanaugh nominees. I don't think Kamala Harris, she's broken like one tie. Right. And we're in a 50-50 Senate, by the way. She should be breaking every tie on every nominee if Republicans were serious. But I genuinely, in talking to some of them and talking to the staff, there is a genuine belief coming from the top, from Mitch McConnell, that if we treat Democrats better than they treated us, we have a self-righteous talking point. Look, we didn't do it. And then somehow that's going to stop them. Right. That this is an actual belief that is held in the Senate, which to me is so divorced from just like reality and even like real politic. Right. Like, I'm not even saying it's divorced from like craven cynicism, which we know runs on Capitol Hill everywhere. But like, this is just how politics works. But they firmly seem to believe that if they have the talking point, well, we didn't do it to you, that's going to stop them, which I mean, guys, wake up.
Yeah, it's kind of institutionalized David Frenchism, right?
It really is. That's great. It's a great point. Yeah.
Losing on substance to have a talking point about how virtuous you are in a year. Like, fantastic, great, no one cares.
Yeah, okay. I'll have to use that turn of phrase, institutionalized David Frenchism, in a future column. But for now, for now, let's move on here. So let's talk about abortion. Last week was the deadline for... at least one side to file amicus briefs in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case, which we've discussed this on previous podcasts. The Supreme Court has granted cert. They've agreed to hear this major abortion case next term pertaining to Mississippi's 15-week gestational limit or ban, rather, on most abortions. So basically, in layman's terms, what that means, like a lot of pro-life amicus briefs were filed like last Thursday, a little over a week ago. And what I was personally was very heartened to see was there were numerous briefs, actually not just one, they're really numerous actually, making the argument that abortion is not merely wrong for the sake that the Constitution is quote unquote silent and that this is traditionally a state's issue, which is kind of the old school Antonin Scalia position. It was kind of like federal society orthodoxy, I guess you might say, for decades. It was frankly in large part why the federal society was founded. But there's kind of this slightly newer argument. There's a 2013 Law Review article from one of my favorite legal academics, Michael Stokes Paulson, that kind of got this ball rolling. My good friend Josh Craddock, when he was a Harvard law student, wrote a pretty influential article on this in 2017. And then most recently, in the April issue of First Thing, so just a few months ago, the esteemed natural law philosopher John Finnis had a really lengthy, like 8,000 to 9,000 word essay, basically arguing that abortion is not merely a quote unquote state issue because the Constitution is quote unquote silent. But the Constitution actually affirmatively prohibits abortion. And then John Finnis paired up with Robbie George, the famous social conservative Princeton professor, they co-wrote an amicus brief in the Dobbs case filed last week making this exact argument. So lot to unpack here. First of all, specifically as kind of just like an Overton window shifting exercise, kind of holding like the legal merits aside, I think this is amazing because like as a pure kind of tactical strategic matter, what this effectively does is it makes like the overturn Roe and make abortion a state's issue effectively out to be kind of like the milquetoast moderate position, which could in theory, at least, you know, if Neil Gorsuch or Clarence Thomas or Sam Alito were to even like imply in a paragraph or two that like they think the John Finnis argument is right, that could provide cover to Brett Kavanaugh or Amy Coney Barrett to potentially go further than they would have otherwise gone and take the now moderate position. The actual legal argument, you know, no reason to get like too deep in the weeds, but like from my perspective, it's eminently plausible. The basic argument is that Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which has the, you know, famous due process of law clause, the equal protection clause, the basic argument is that where the term person is used, especially in the due process clause and the equal protection clause, it was understood in 1868, the year that the amendment was ratified, that person refers to all natural people, both born and unborn. And there's some evidence of this on both sides. I think there's probably more evidence, frankly, in the historical record on the John Finnis abortion is unconstitutional argument. You can easily get there when you kind of ditch this, what I would call overly positivist approach and, you know, and embrace the red pill of what I call common good originalism, which argues that when you have kind of competing plausible interpretations, you should always err on the side of natural justice and kind of the overarching telos, the purpose of the American constitutional order as laid out in the Declaration and the preamble. So I think you can probably easily get there, but more generally speaking, just as kind of like, you know, as a pro-lifer who's marches for life, I'm encouraged that this argument is just getting out there. Because again, I for, especially for purposes of our discussion here, I'm less focused on kind of the legal intricacies of the debate. And it's just an important kind of Overton window shift in the abortion discourse. Now, would I be happy like if the quote unquote moderate position of just like Roe's overturned and abortion's returned? Say, yeah, of course I would. I mean, like it's quite plausible there's not a single vote on the current court to take the abortionist straight up unconstitutional argument. But from a pro-life perspective, I think it's important that these arguments are even getting out there. And, you know, look, I mean, like I at some point, this has been a recurring theme in my articles on judicial supremacy for years. At some point, like how many more unborn children must die? Like before, like we just like try to come around and embrace positions like this. So I'm happy to throw it open to the group. You know, I assume that we're mostly happy with this, but maybe there's a skeptic or cynic out there.
No, I think that's right. Like I am glad the personhood argument's being made finally, right? Because I think there's been a lot of conservatives that have been waiting for this to take shape. And I think one interesting thing, and I've heard this, Josh, maybe and you can confirm it, is something that goes, I think, to a little bit of the corruption that exists in some parts of how the institutional pro-life movement in DC is operated is that I think it was like National Right to Life that filed an amicus brief that couldn't even bring itself to call for the repeal of Roe and Casey. This is
exactly
allegedly the preeminent pro-life movement center, you know, centerpiece in DC, and they can't even ask for the baseline, which is a repeal of these, you know, horrible decisions. And so I think that tells you where the institutional movement is, and not all those all the groups are like this, right? I'm just talking about National Right to Life, but there's a huge vacuum here, and I'm really glad to see this development. But not being a lawyer, I throw it open to Will as well.
Sure. I mean, I think it's, you know, I guess I'm the one secular person on the panel probably, but I still think it's a good thing. I think in any debate where you're actually trying to move the ball forward, you need to make sure you aren't just over, you know, you aren't like, what's the right word, essentially? Like selling after the close, or you're basically, you want to make sure you're making your aggressive arguments and not just closing them off. So I think that, you know, if there is a plausible substantive argument that abortion is unconstitutional, then certainly the right should be making it. And if only to open up the space for actually a moderate counterproposal. And I like to think about this all the time. You know, people say to me, it's like, well, we just need to get the government out of funding Planned Parenthood. I'm like, no. You don't figure out, that's not where you start. You start with, we need an Affordable Arms Act, so we subsidize AR-15 ownership all around the country. And if the left doesn't like that, then maybe they should realize that maybe we shouldn't be subsidizing things that everybody else likes. I mean, I can imagine, I think the NRA could really use a government subsidy. They're almost going bankrupt, right? So let's you know, if Planned Parenthood gets money, like the NRA should be getting billions and billions of taxpayer dollars specifically, and probably funded by an increase in the salt cap, so we can get more money from
Sorry, I probably should have clarified this, but before I kick it over to Emily, just to make sure we're all clear, because sometimes I forget that, like, I'm a lawyer. I don't, like, make these things clear to everyone. I hopefully it was already clear. So, like, when I say abortion is unconstitutional in the 14th Amendment, I mean that states are required to protect unborn life. So even, like, if this argument were to theoretically take hold, you know, even like the bluest of blue states, like New York, California, could not legalize abortion. But anyway, I just wanted to clarify that. But
and I want to, can I just get one more point?
Yeah,
I wanted
yeah,
to talk about that legal aspect, because I didn't get there. I do think, you know, I actually have to read the legal literature more, but just thinking off the cuff, I think actually prevailing on this argument that abortion was unconstitutional might pose some problems, in the sense that, you know, if it's a 14th Amendment style argument where basically you have to, you know, equal protection, you have to treat an unborn life exactly the same way you would treat an adult life, that could lead to some consequences legally that maybe even the pro-life movement doesn't want. Like, how dramatically do you have to punish, you know, potential mothers who get an abortion? Like, you know, are they accessories to murder and facing 20 years? And so there might, I think it's one of those situations where you might not want to win all the way that far and just get it to the point where your states can ban it, or that you are still in the world where you're not constrained to punish abortion the exact same way you would punish first degree murder, for example. But I don't know if that necessarily follows from this 14th Amendment argument, but it strikes me as, like, there's that obvious tension. Like, if we're talking about equal protection and this life needs to be treated exactly the way that life needs to be treated, that could pose some problems. But that's just something that occurs to me.
I mean, yeah, and it's a good point. And I think it's one that people in the pro-life movement should start to think more intensely about, because I do think the good news is that we're moving much, much, much closer to a more just system for the unborn. And I think the left senses that and is pretty freaked out about that. I think you can see it when you look at the pro-choice movement, the anti-abortion movement, or the pro-abortion movement. They are, I think, increasingly anxious about what could happen in the Supreme Court. And Josh's way of framing this conversation about perhaps an indication the Overton window may be expanding or shifting is an important one, because I think it's also these discussions and these legal frameworks are being proposed at a time when younger people are at least shifting in a way prior generations hadn't, thanks to technology. And so, again, I think the left is very anxious about this, and I think that does mean that people in the pro-life movement need to fully think through what some of this would mean for the country and what it would mean for state laws that people would want to develop. I actually think, to Will's point, a whole lot of, like, Republican men in particular might blanch at exactly the scenario he just laid out. But in a world where our cultural understanding of abortion is murder, is as murder, well, then we have to have that conversation. And we're not in a place yet where most people understand it that way. I don't think that's true. I just don't think most people know, understand the science, and that's a different sort of situation. But if we ever get to a point where, you know, we have to talk about it that way, it's a very different conversation. And I think, basically, I think stuff is starting to get real. And it's always been real, but like the possibility is upon us. The plausibility of that happening is upon us. And on that note, unless, does anyone have any final thoughts on this topic?
Just real quick, and then I'll toss it back to you. So I don't think that if this argument were to take hold, which again, it's not. I mean, it's kind of sort of the window shifting paradigm, but if this were to one day become like the law of the land, so to speak, it's not so much that every abortion would be treated as equivalent to first degree murder, rather kind of our homicide criminal statutes in general would have to include abortion as some form of homicide. You can go back to like 17th century English common law and there's certain ways there. So it wouldn't be punished the same as like, you know, first degree contemplated murder, but it would have to be punished. But anyway, on that note, Emily, tell us about Facebook.
No, Josh just made a point from the lawyer's perspective that I was making from a layman's perspective. So that was actually pretty helpful for myself. So Mark Zuckerberg gave an interview to The Verge in late July that I think went under the radar to an extent that was not at all helpful, because he was talking about some truly major groundbreaking things that are in the work at one of the world's most powerful companies, and that would be Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg said basically he believes the frontier for his company is Facebook, and that within the coming years, people will stop seeing Facebook as a social media company if his plan is fulfilled and start seeing it primarily as a metaverse company. This issue is interesting to me in particular because I bought an Oculus this year. I actually didn't know it was a Facebook device. It arrived in the mail in a book in a box that said Facebook on the top of it. And I was like, oh no, what have I done? And I love it. You know, I work out on it. I think they're amazing, but they're terrifying. This is like truly terrifying technology. If you haven't had a chance to try one of the Oculus Quest devices, you really, really should, because it's something that feels like it's in the future, right? Like the future is now type of thing. It's an experience that feels like we shouldn't have the technology to enjoy at this point, but it is really so radically different than any other device that we have right now. And as Mark Zuckerberg is talking in The Verge, I'm just going to read a quote, because I just think it's really important. When he talks about the metaverse, he's essentially talking about virtual reality, about having meetings, not over Zoom, so in the sort of flat space, but in a three-dimensional space where you're physically, it looks like you're sitting next to the person on your Zoom meeting. So like all of us would be physically around like a table that would be facilitated by the technology. And Zuckerberg says, what virtual and augmented reality can do, and what the metaverse broadly is going to help people experience, is a sense of presence that I think is just much more natural in the way that we're made to interact. And I think it will be more comfortable. The interactions that we have will be a lot richer. They'll feel real. In the future, instead of just doing this over a phone call, you'll be able to sit as a hologram on my couch. Okay, if there's anybody that we should not treat as an authority on what will feel real, it is Mark Zuckerberg. And in this conversation, he is conceding a flaw in his own product and in the social network that he created, which is that there's a synthetic quality to the relationships that are cultivated and facilitated by that product. So there's a little bit of a concession there. But the notion that us all, so like for instance, when I'm doing a boxing class on my Oculus, people that are also playing it in real time around the world, I can see them standing next to me. Like the sensation is that you are standing next to them and they're boxing along with you. Like you can, it looks like when you have the headset on, they're 3 feet away from you, but they're actually in like Japan. So it's strange, but this is the future that Mark Zuckerberg, the news value of what we want to talk about here and what I want to get your guys' thoughts on, is we now know that one of the most powerful billionaires in the world, who is overseeing one of the most powerful companies, is actively working to thrust us into a metaverse immersively, that would be what our days, our professional life, and our social lives are immersed in on a daily basis, you wake up, you put your headset on, whether it's small glasses or whatever, they're trying to make them more compact and lightweight at this point. This is what one of the biggest, most powerful companies in the world is actively working on right now. Zuckerberg's insight, I think, gave us terrifying but important insight into those plans. So with that, I'll just ask what all of you guys think about this.
I'll go first on this one. If Zuckerberg's working on this, you know, my big issue with social media is access, right? I'm platform access is civil right. I basically think everybody needs to have access to Facebook. I've pushed that for a long time. But I look at, this is part of the, I think part of the broader war between technology and politics, right? Like if you've experienced anything over the last year, it's that, hey, city living has big flaws. I was living in Washington, D.C. and seeing riots and crazy stuff. And the problem is, it's like, if you don't have city living, you lose access to that sort of connection to people and the ability to interact with them reasonably. I think if the metaverse becomes real, there is a big positive to that, which is that cities then face yet another competitive pressure to be responsive to their citizens and actually not be terrible, like San Francisco is turning into this just horror show. The more technology facilitates people not having to live in these terrible Democrat cities, I don't think that's inherently a bad thing. Now, is that, you know, do we want to, you know, there are obviously negatives of the fact that that is not a synthetic facsimile of what real world interaction is like. But I don't know, I'm not willing to believe in the power and the justness of Democrat mayors to resurrect some of their cities. Like I just watching what's happened to DC in just the past year. Is really dramatic and bad. And so I kind of see the metaverse and like, and all these sort of like Zoom technologies and kind of that context where they're, you know, they are building the alternative to city living for professionals.
So just a quick point of clarification. I'm still trying to figure out what the metaverse is. It's like a virtual reality escape from like your actual life. Is that basically what this is?
It's not even an escape. It's just another option. So for instance, there's apps on Oculus right now. By the way, I'm not a gamer at all. Like I got it because I was playing like ping pong at a friend's on their Oculus. And I was like, oh, actually, this is pretty cool. There are apps right now that will put you at a desk with like 10 monitors and you could get all your stuff up on the 10 monitors and it looks like you're in 3D. So Zuckerberg's goal is so that when you go to work at 9 a.m., you pop on your headset and you're at home, but you're actually, the sensation is that you are in a physical office space with 10 of your colleagues that look three-dimensional and in the same spot. And then that can also be replicated with watching Netflix, which you can actually already do on the Oculus. You're on a couch next to your friend if they also have a headset. It's wild, but it's basically a virtual reality that would be a substitute for everything we do in person.
Wow. While I process that, Rachel, if you have any thoughts.
Well, you know, this is the whole debate about technology, right? And I'm not a Luddite by any means. You know, I'm sitting here on Zoom with my iPhone next to me. But this is the whole debate about how these companies move so quickly to change very seriously and fundamentally what it is to be human, how it is to have human interaction, like the costs and trade-offs of, you know, what would be travel that is not required, you know, all these things that make us human are sort of just being parsed and pushed away by all these developments. And that's probably always been true to some extent, you know, the way that technology develops, that always happens. But I think it's happening at such a rapid pace in the time that we live now that it's like whiplash, like we almost don't even get a say. You know, suddenly this, what was a cool technology, you know, for watching Netflix with your friends is like controlling, you know, 80% of the workspace. And it's like suddenly 5 years from now, we wake up and that's the case. And so my role as a commentator on these issues has always just been to say, what are the trade-offs here? What are we doing? What is being consented to on our behalf because something's cool and sexy, you know, without thinking about the long-term consequences? Again, of things that conservatives have always valued, you know, a traditional order in Oculus probably looks a lot different than the traditional order that we've prioritized for the last, you know, several hundred years. And that should be discussed and those trade-offs should be thoughtfully examined. And you know, that's true of all technology, but especially one that I think changes how humans interact and what it actually means to be, you know, a good citizen or a good family member. You know, all these things kind of come into play when you're talking about especially a virtual reality.
Yeah. Okay. So I really don't have a whole lot to add to what Rachel said. Her take is basically my take. You know, I'm in the DC area this week to do a legal fellowship that I'm like years overdue to do. It's the James Wilson Institute's fellowship. And my friend Tom Johnson was in yesterday. Tom's the former chief counsel, general counsel, whatever his title was, to Ajit Pai when Ajit was a chairman of the FCC. And we kind of got into this discussion a little bit. We talked about like the point which technology becomes kind of like a net harm. And no, we're not Luddites to point out that a lot of this does, I think, ultimately like redound against like basic human needs, basic humanity. You know, James Poulos writes about this all the time, right? I mean, kind of there's the center he's affiliated with, the Center for the Study of Digital Life, or whatever the exact title is. There are real downsides, and there was one like tangible kind of blog post from last year. Rusty Reno was blogging, I think, at Orencast's American Composite. I can't quite remember. He made one argument for kind of what like a future where like the Zoom work from home culture would really kind of take hold and look like. He made this argument, and it really kind of made sense to me so much so that I was kind of scared. Was look, at some point, you just simply cannot replace human-to-human interaction, okay? Like a lot of these companies, a lot of these like tech companies, especially in like the Silicon Valley world or whatever, a lot of like these new startups kind of emanate ultimately from the proverbial like water cooler conversation, from like the grab a drink at the local bar after work kind of stuff. I mean, I don't know, like the way that like Emily describes the metaverse, and you know, my like quasi boomer self doesn't pretend to fully understand it still, but like to the extent that I grasp it, I have a hard time seeing this like a true replacement for the kind of like intimate human, not sexually intimate, but like close encounter conversations that would like need to be had in order to kind of generate the sort of human capital and social capital to kind of get startup culture going. So I can just like easily foresee like very, very real downside risk if this sort of thing were to take hold, is I guess my, you know, somewhat negative take.
Well, to that point, by the way, if we think the pornography addictions are bad right now, pornography addictions will be much worse in the metaverse. And you know, these are just some of the things to think about as we go forward on that. And Zuckerberg is not very good about predicting the potential consequences of his products, as Rachel has documented with the Backpage, the way that Facebook was used with by Backpage and sex trafficking, essentially. So on that note, Will, you're in for Ben today. What do you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk about the eviction moratorium. I mean, that's all over the news. The CDC deciding to, you know, implement an extension or a new eviction moratorium, preventing landlords from evicting their tenants. I think this was originally done under the Trump administration. We had a Supreme Court opinion in either June or July saying that, well, not they weren't going to, you know, get rid of the stay of an injunction or something, but basically, we have five justices who think this is clearly unconstitutional. And yet today we have Joe Biden, you know, saying before he doesn't really think it's constitutional and then doing it anyway. And today I think I have this tweet from Philip Wegman at Real Clear, who asked the President Biden why the eviction moratorium is constitutional. And Biden's answer was, quote, "I can't guarantee you the court won't rule that we don't have that authority, but at least we'll have the ability to, if we have to appeal, to keep this going for a month, at least, I hope longer." And so I have two basic impulses about this. One is, this is appalling. It's, you know, he takes an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and he's knowingly violating that oath. In a normal world, in the classic sense, that's impeachable, right? Knowing violation of an oath that you take the oath of office. But the second part of me is the creative part. And I'm like, okay, well, if this is the new, you know, I'm not a fan of unilateral disarmament. If this is the new rule, what creative things can we do when we have control of the White House again, where we can just implement some temporary policy we know is unlawful, but do it because it provides us some political advantage? Like, I don't know, maybe we seize Harvard University and turn it into a COVID field hospital under CDC guidelines because, you know, there's a lot of dorm space. It would be wonderful. And that's clearly, you know, if the authority extends this far to every landlord in the country, surely it can extend to a few dormitories. And, you know, just so happens that the classes will have to stop for, you know, as long as the appeals take, but, you know, no real loss there. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of throw both of those out there. Like, is this, you know, I talked before, you know, people are always worried about Democrats doing unprecedented things. Or sorry, people are always worried about Republicans setting a bad precedent, but Democrats do unprecedented things all the time. This is legitimately unprecedented, I think, for a White House to implement a knowingly unconstitutional policy on, and the basis for doing so is we think it will get reversed, but in the we only need it for a short amount of time, so we're just going to do something unlawful and YOLO it.
So, well, I guess that's the question for that I actually have for Josh. I was going to ask, like, do you guys think it will get reversed? Because this really depends on Kavanaugh, like, seeing it through.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of takes on this. So the order from late June, I think it was like June 29th, that Will mentioned, Alabama Realtors Association, whatever, you know, Kavanaugh has literally one paragraph, right, saying that, like, this is not lawful, but for, like, pure equitable reasons. I mean, that was crazy when he wrote it. It's still crazy today. I mean, if the whole, like, John Roberts line about, like, a judge being an umpire calling balls and strikes means anything, it means that, like, if you are confident that something is unlawful, you declare it to be unlawful. Like, really, period, kind of end of story, right? So before we get into law, there's obviously kind of like an economic debate to be had, right, about this eviction moratorium as well. And, like, I guess the only thing that I'll say on that front is, you know, it's very easy for kind of AOC and Cori Bush and for everyone out there to kind of get up there and, like, lament tenants and all that. And I have no doubt whatsoever that there are many people that are still economically suffering as we continue to try to climb back our way out of this self-inflicted COVID economic disaster. But the only point I'll make, and I'm hardly alone in making it, there are any number of, like, small landlords, right? I mean, there are any number of kind of, like, small mom and pop shop, like people that themselves are struggling because they're not getting any income right now. So, I mean, like, where's, like, the sympathy for them? Where's the justice for them, I guess? So that's actually the economic point I'll make. Going back to the law here, so there's a lot to be said for this. I kind of have conflicting thoughts. It sounds like kind of similar to what Will has. On the one hand, this notion that an executive, like, can do something while simultaneously thinking it's unlawful is totally nonsense. I think back to the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill from, like, 2001. I think it was just after George W. Bush became president, or maybe it was 02, it was right around there. And he had, like, one of these so-called signing statements, which themselves are kind of an atrocity, honestly. And, like, in, like, this, like, short signing statement, President Bush says, "I believe this is unconstitutional as a First Amendment violation, but, like, I'm going to sign anyway and, like, let the court do what it's going to do." This is just, like, a fundamental misunderstanding as to how constitutional interpretation works, or how it at least in theory ought to work. The notion that the Supreme Court is the sole, final, and binding arbiter of every legal dispute is completely nonsensical. I feel like a cliche saying this, but Abraham Lincoln, of course, very famously opposed this over and over again. He said that Dred Scott, the infamous decision with respect to slavery in the Western territories, would apply only to the named parties to the lawsuit, but it was not a political rule. He would not respect it, anything other than that. I am not morally equating Dred Scott to the eviction moratorium, but the principle at least still stands here. So my slightly more optimistic red pill take, which is kind of what Will was saying, is if we're going to take on judicial supremacy as a precedent, if the Democrats, you know, are going to join us in this, then yeah, I can think of, like, a million different ways that, like, Republicans can, like, plan in advance probably to have fun with this next time the Republicans have someone in the White House. So that's, like, my slightly half glass full take. But look, the president, this is an impeachable offense in theory. Will's absolutely right about this. I mean, the president, in shirking his constitutional oath and just kind of, like, offloading it to the courts, in a proper understanding of the oath of office requirements, I think that would be an impeachable offense, because the executive, just like every senator and congressman, has his or her own independent prerogative to interpret, enforce, and carry out the Constitution as they understand it.
So I have a non-legal take, because I'm a Philistine and don't have a law degree, but what was shocking to me about this whole situation was actually the fact that Cori Bush was so lionized and embraced by her own party for doing what she did, because obviously I come at it from the conservative perspective thinking, one, no conservative would ever have the balls to do what she did, which is to, like, set up a protest like this, you know, and demand national attention to do it. Like, no conservative would ever do that. And in fairness, they wouldn't get probably the coverage, or they would get it and be totally mocked for it. But the second thing is, if a conservative were to do it, they would, and against their own party, which is what Cori Bush was doing, they would be kicked out of the party effectively, right? Like, a primary challenger would be announced immediately, you know, with endorsements from Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell. Like, they wouldn't stand for this kind of behavior. So it's just always interesting to me to contrast, you know, how willing the left is to go to the mat for what they care about, where, again, coming back to even full circle to my segment, like, you can't even get Republicans to pick up the phone when they have, you know, obvious evidence that vastly already unqualified nominee has further, you know, evidence that he can't do the job. And so that's always striking to me. But I think, you know, I completely agree that the law is just being ignored here. But the point that should be discussed in so much of the discourse that's not is that middle class landlord, you know, are the people that, again, aren't the big rental corporations, you know, that are getting screwed here. They're people who don't maybe make $40,000 a year in rental income, which is not much, right? And this is how people generate wealth, is like through property, through renting it out, through owning it. And this is a huge source for the middle class. And we're just like, yeah, sorry, screw you. That I think is the real tragedy here, and just goes to show you where Democrats' priorities lie, I think, in this case.
Yeah, and I'll quickly wrap up by saying exactly what Rachel just said is why in all of these populist conversations, the right cannot afford, and the country cannot afford the right, to cede this discussion to the populist left, which would take us towards a social democracy, European style social democracy, if it had its way. There is no limiting principle here. Joe Biden is their so-called moderate centrist president, and he is literally violating his oath of office openly, I mean, flagrantly, to as a means to this end, which is the most important thing in the world for Democrats right now. And maybe maybe there's a practical argument to be made for the policy itself, not the way that it was accomplished. And if we had a functioning legislative body, then you know, this could be a very different situation for Joe Biden and for Republicans. But this idea that because people are downtrodden and disenfranchised, we have an obligation to help them via other taxpayers' money, there is no limiting principle there, exactly as Will said. That means that private property can then be ceded. And that's exactly what's happening. That's exactly what's happening. And a lot of these middle-class landlords are not going to get paid back. Big government is good for big business. This is a lot less of an issue for those massive hedge fund-owned apartment companies and those buildings than it is for the middle class landlords, of which there are many. So when we have these conversations about shifting the Republican Party's focus from, you know, one that's just fixated on GDP, and shifting the Republican Party's focus on you know, this sort of zombie Reaganism, as it's derisively called, we at the same time can't cede the entire conversation to those who would take us towards a European style central socialized democracy, because there is no limiting principle to it. And it will absolutely not just wreck our economy, it will wreck communities. We've seen that happen when we've experimented with these policies in this country. So that's what I think about that. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And I'm really glad that Will had us talk about it, because if Donald Trump had done this, I mean, for all of the impeachable offenses that people said Donald Trump violated his oath of office over and over and over again, nothing was like as flagrant as this and shameless as this.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think that, you know, one point everybody's talking about on the economic side, you know, we're gonna squeeze out middle class landlords. That land being a landlord is gonna be yet another type of business that you need clout to effectively participate in. And so that's gonna mean it's the Black Rocks of the world can be landlord, because they're the ones who can lobby an administration and make sure the CDC doesn't randomly cut off all their entire revenue stream.
That is a great point.
Yeah.
So on that note, let's go around and everyone just share your final thoughts. Who wants to go first?
I can go first with sort of the thought that a theme I talk about a lot here is the failure of our representative self-government. And by that, I mean our legislature, by and large. And I think it just is on such display in some of the issues that we've talked about here, because obviously, like, Congress could have and should have been the ones to deal with this eviction moratorium. That is just like civics 101. This is not hard to understand, right? But the fact that they didn't, the fact that they kicked the can down and then completely accept, by the way, like, not only is it, I think, functionally like illegal for Biden to do what he did, but Congress was okay with it. Congress was like, yes, please step all over our lawmaking authority. We love it when you do that. But I think on a more sort of meta narrative level, it goes back to something Emily was saying about the metaverse, the meta narrative about the metaverse, that when she was talking about Mark Zuckerberg, you know, not being always aware of or a good predictor of what the long-term consequences will be. Yeah, because that's not his job, right? It is the goal of the legislature, the purpose of the self-government, to set those limits. This is true about science and research. This is also true about technology. Innovation in these spaces is always going to propel itself forward. That's the point. It's always the goal of the legislative representative body to say, this is where we draw the line. And we don't do it. because we have a failure of a Congress. We have people that are just uninterested in doing anything, but again, you know, setting up their future corporate board spot. And so they don't want to take on these issues of what it, and to really wrestle with what it means to live together in a society that we all agree to. So that's, you know, something I talk about a lot, but it really struck me in those two segments that, again, you know, our self-government is failing us.
So I have a final thought on a subject that we didn't come anywhere close to touching on today, but I think it's important, which is Tucker Carlson filming this entire week's show from Budapest, Hungary. And this kind of has generated a lot of attention on Twitter. We're recording this on Thursday, August 5th. This morning, I believe it was Jay Nordlinger, who was kind of an institutional bastion at National Review, kind of phrased this as kind of like this conflict between the illiberal Orbanistas, that's a reference to, of course, Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, versus kind of the remaining clinging old school Reagan conservatives. Yoram Hazony, who's the, you know, the head honcho here at the Edmund Burke Foundation, quote tweeted that and basically said this is like a total like ahistorical, like Ronald Reagan understood that you have to have this kind of coalition between more like traditionalist Burkean nationalist conservatives and kind of, you know, free market first kind of folks. But anyway, all that's to say, I think it's really important for the movement that Tucker has chosen to do this. And, you know, he, I think he went over to speak at kind of a symposium for a think tank there called MCC. I have plenty of friends there as well, but it's important, I think, and I we talked about this in previous shows. I wrote a column about like Central and Eastern Europe a couple months ago or so, but it's important for American conservatives to kind of, I think, get out of the mentality that what we were doing 30, 40 years ago, what kind of elite American institutional kind of white papers were releasing, what was coming out of kind of one right-leaning university, doesn't mean that that is necessarily the right way to go. For all time. Our principles are timeless. The prudential application of those principles necessarily changes. And there's been this huge conflation over the past 50, 60 years, another running theme of this podcast, has been a huge conflation between principles and prudence. And a lot of what's happening right now in Central and Eastern Europe is they are taking a lot of similar principles, looking at the situation around it, kind of neoliberalism, globalism, kind of run amok. Obviously, there's kind of an immigration crisis in Europe, hasn't for the past 10, 15 years, and they are applying it in a different way. Family policy, of course, being one example as well. So anyway, all I'll say, good for Tucker. I was really happy to see this. He had an incredibly high energy monologue the other night about kind of going to the Hungarian-Serbian border and like what they're doing right on that border. I hope that more American conservatives are paying attention, and I'm happy that Tucker is shining a spotlight on it.
Cool. Well, I'll rant off of that because that leads to a better final thought. So I think, you know, another, you made the point about the distinction between principles and prudence. I think one that the right generally has ignored is the distinction between a principle and a heuristic, right? A principle is actually an idea that you stick to no matter what. A heuristic is a rule of thumb. So when somebody says they're a principled small government person, I'm like, that's a contradiction in terms. What do you mean you're a principled small government person? So you always have an exception to your principle. Government is bad, except in this set of few instances. That's a rule of thumb. It's a general concept. And I think, you know, I deal with this problem all the time when I'm talking about big tech. It's, you know, I had a debate against Carl Szabo, some big tech lobbyist down in Florida a few weeks ago, where he's talking about, well, we have to adhere to our conservative principles, not to interfere in the workings of private companies. You mean the ones that we overlooked? I mean, are you seriously going to get up here and argue against the Civil Rights Act of 1964? Like, are you, you're pro? I mean, how far does your principle go? It doesn't go that far. So really, it's just a heuristic saying that we're going to, as a general matter, we should try and not intervene in the affairs of private companies. But that doesn't mean that's a principle. You know, a principle is like freedom of speech, the idea that you should be able to speak your mind. You know, that's a real principle. And so in general, the right shouldn't get, when you're listening to people advocating your own against your interests, and then appealing to principle, query whether that is in fact a principle or is merely a rule of thumb.
I'll also get meta about the metaverse like Rachel did and say this entire conversation has been facilitated in a way that would have been unthinkable in the year that most of us were born, right? Like we didn't have this kind of technology and it wasn't something that you could do very easily. So I guess it's this is, there's a very rapid acceleration of technological advancement. And I put that in scare quotes because we don't actually know how much it's actually advancing us. But this is the way that we talk about our politics has been so profoundly disrupted by Mark Zuckerberg's technology, by Jack Dorsey's technology, the way we interact with each other, literally our sexual health, all of these things has been disrupted by their technology and what they have gotten really, really rich off of. And so we are now entrusting them with, as Rachel says, something they're not really morally equipped, these questions they're not really morally equipped to answer. And this is all happening at a time of, I think, as the technology is accelerating, so is the secularism. And as the secularism accelerates like alongside the technology, we cannot trust the market necessarily, or we should be very nervous about how the market will sort of sort the wheat from the chaff, right? Like, how are we going to have products when we're already, you know, when we're already losing our sense of shame? How are we going to have products that allow us to actually fix our politics? It's not going to be, you know, us sitting in a room that looks 3D. That's actually not going to help us have these conversations better. It's going to make us fatter. It's going to make us more depressed. It's going to make us more hateful. It's not going to improve any of those measures. And it's going to suck us more and more out of the world that we're in. We talk about how people already have a hard enough time understanding the humanity of the unborn and the life that is inside women when they're carrying the unborn. That has changed as technology has increased. But all of these other technological increases or advancements, so-called advancements, are to dehumanize us. They take us out of the human-to-human interaction and they put up technological buffers between them. So I think we're heading into something very ugly, but I guess the benefit is that we are having these conversations. I'm not sure that we need the lovely Chinese technology Zoom to do it, but we are at least having the conversations. And the more that we're aware of the danger of the direction we're going in, I think the better prepared we will be to deal with it. So on that note, on behalf of Will, Rachel, Josh, and myself, I'm going to thank you guys for tuning in. I'm Emily Jastrzynski, and we'll see you on the next NatCon Squad.